From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are following news on a number of fronts today. There's a new warning that this winter could bring a second wave of the pandemic, but many states are moving ahead with plans to reopen parts of their economies. Others are being more cautious.
In Washington state, restrictions on public life will remain in place for weeks now, even though the coronavirus cases appear to have peaked there last month. Governor Jay Inslee says that while the state's spread of COVID-19 is likely on the decline, many of Washington's stay-at-home restrictions will stay in effect past the previously set expiration date of May 4th. And joining us now for more is Austin Jenkins. He's political reporter for the Northwest News Network. And Austin, what more did Inslee say?
Well, in a televised address last night, the governor said that unlocking the economy here will look more like the turning of a dial than the flip of a switch. And he warned that many of the restrictions that are in place today under his stay-home order are likely to extend past May 4th when that order is set to expire.
Okay. So Republican governors from four southern states have been criticized for their plans to roll back these social distancing measures over the next few weeks. But Washington is one of several states where there have been these protests of these stay-at-home orders. How are people reacting to the state's plans?
You know, by and large, I think the sense is that of the 7.6 million people in this state, there's large buy-in and cooperation and adherence to these orders. And that's essentially staying home and not being out and about as much as possible. And if you're a non-essential business, closing up shop. That said, I'm sensing that there is a little bit more frustration building. We had 2,500 people at the Capitol protesting on Sunday. Franklin County over in southeast Washington, which is a more conservative county, has now voted to reopen in direct defiance of the governor's order. So I don't think there's widespread opposition or resistance at this point, but there's certainly some of that kind of burbling beneath the surface and now coming up.
Okay, I want to ask you one more thing. Inslee also said last night that he sent a letter to Vice President Mike Pence asking for more help with test kits and contact tracing. How many people in Washington state are being tested, and how far behind is this whole effort from where public health officials say they need to be?
You know, we've been asking for these data points for a long time, and finally we're starting to hear some specifics. So sounds like at its peak, the state of Washington, which by the way has plenty of lab capacity, the issue has been testing capacity, was testing about 4,000 people a day. That's actually dropped down recently, and they're not sure if that's because of less demand or because supplies are so tight. But what the governor says is the goal is to be testing 20,000 to 30,000 people a day. And that is so important in terms of having that public health surveillance system in place so that as you're unlocking the economy, you can spot new cases and flare-ups and extinguish them quickly. So we're a long ways from what the governor thinks we need to be in terms of full testing capability, or what you might call widespread testing.
That's Austin Jenkins, political reporter for the Northwest News Network. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, it turns out that some of the protests against stay-at-home orders that are popping up across the country aren't as grassroots as they seem. Many have gotten a boost from conservative organizers online, something called astroturfing. Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now, has that story. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, just remind us what astroturfing is.
Right. So put simply, astroturfing is this process where you try to disguise the origins of a highly coordinated or organized effort or message by making it seem like it's a much more kind of spontaneous grassroots thing. Grassroots is the real thing. Astroturfing, of course, is fake grass, right? So this has been happening forever, but it's happening more frequently and to greater effect, basically because the internet, as they say. You can see examples of astroturfing everywhere from Amazon product reviews to online petitions to political organizing. And it can be confusing because astroturfing sometimes happens at the same time as grassroots efforts. So it can be hard to tell the difference.
And why do people think that there's astroturfing happening with these protests against stay-at-home orders?
Right. So these protests first started popping up around the country, Michigan, Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and people on internet forums started to notice that a lot of the online presences of these protest groups looked really similar. They were using the same names for their groups and protests. They were also using a lot of the exact same imagery and the exact same language describing the groups in totally different states. And maybe most importantly, a lot of these Facebook groups and website domains popped up in really quick succession. Like, it wasn't like they were sort of inspiring each other. They were being created at the exact same time.
And who was creating these websites and Facebook groups?
So in the case of Facebook, you've seen over 100 of these groups pop up in the last 2 weeks, and some of the biggest of these Facebook groups have been created by the Doerr brothers. Now, the Doerr brothers, Ben, Christopher, Aaron, and Matthew Doerr, are part of this Minnesota family that runs a number of successful gun rights advocacy groups and charities that bring in a lot of money by rallying around ideas like the National Rifle Association isn't pro-gun enough, so they're pretty far right. What they appear to have done here is that they've taken a pretty large online audience base in their existing Facebook groups and used it to populate new Facebook groups, creating a kind of data harvesting feedback loop where current Facebook group members are prompted to go to new websites to give their data for fundraising and organizing. And these efforts have now fed into growing support from more familiar names like FreedomWorks and Tea Party Patriots, right? Conservative groups that by now are really well resourced and established and part of the sort of political machinery of the right.
Well, when you bring up the Tea Party, it does sound like some of this is sort of business as usual in the world of politics. Is there something unique about the way in which these anti-stay-at-home order protests are happening right now?
I think what's notable and unique here is that a lot of the way these protests around the country were first reported on, they appeared organic and spontaneous. And while that is partially true, there are real people who are showing up to these protests with real frustrations about stay-at-home orders and economic hardship. When you look carefully at how these protests were organized, you see a high level of coordination. And especially in 2020, it's important to understand the somewhat artificial origins of what might become a larger political movement and tapping into very real feelings of people around the country, and that we're probably going to see even more astroturfing mixed in with the real stuff as the year goes on into the election.
That is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for us at Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
President Trump started the day by issuing a warning or threat to Iran, saying the U.S. would destroy Iranian boats or planes if they harass American forces. It's part of the nearly two-year-old so-called maximum pressure campaign. The administration has carried out a campaign critics say doesn't seem to be changing Iran's behavior. The administration is also keeping up pressure on another rival today, China. This news came from new comments made by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman is here covering all of this, and she joins us now. And Michelle, first, let's talk about Iran. President Trump is threatening military action again. This is a few months after the U.S. killed that top Iranian commander. And in response, Iran launched a missile barrage at U.S. troops. What's the latest with this tweet that the president tweeted out earlier?
Well, there have been kind of a series of incidents in the Persian Gulf, small Iranian boats coming close to U.S. warships. Trump's tweet was in response to that. But it also came on a day when there was news of an Iranian satellite launch, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made clear that he thinks the U.N. Security Council should be holding Iran to account for that.
Yeah. So this is part of that long anti-Iran campaign. What more did he say today, Secretary Mike Pompeo?
He was complaining that while Iran says it needs more money and sanctions relief to deal with the coronavirus pandemic, it is still kind of up to no good in the region. He went through a long list of what the Iranians have been up to, including that satellite launch, including attacks by Iranian-backed Shiite militias in Iraq on U.S. forces or tensions there. All of this has been simmering, you know, for a really long time. And you might remember that when the U.S. killed Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Trump administration said that the action restored deterrence. But it looked like, looks now like Iran hasn't been deterred.
Yeah, I mean, that really is the big question. Our attention has not been on this for quite a while since Soleimani's death. But is this maximum pressure campaign getting the results that the U.S. said it wants?
Well, it depends on what you think what the U.S. really wants out of the maximum pressure campaign. I mean, I spoke recently with Ariane Tabatabai. She's an Iran expert with the German Marshall Fund. And she says one of the problems is that neither side really seems to be interested in negotiations, kind of a diplomatic off-ramp to this. It's a distraction for the U.S. to be talking tough about Iran. And it's a distraction for the Iranians who are really struggling to deal with the coronavirus outbreak at home. Europeans have wanted to help out and to be that diplomatic off-ramp, but she says that neither side really seems interested in that.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about China. Pompeo also said he talked about China a little bit today. What can you update us on with that situation?
Well, he's blaming the Chinese Communist Party, as he always says, for failing to report the outbreak of the new coronavirus in a timely manner to the WHO. He pointed out that WHO rules require that member states do that. So he's keeping the focus on that. And he also raised concerns about China's recent actions in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea, saying China's taking advantage of this moment.
That's NPR's Michelle Kellerman. Michelle, thank you very much.
Sure thing. Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Each day we've been checking in on countries around the world and how they're handling the coronavirus pandemic. Poland now has more infections than any country in post-communist Central Europe. Joining us now is the BBC's Adam Easton, who's on Skype from Warsaw. Adam, tell us more about the latest report from Poland's health ministry, which was released today. What does it say?
Yes, the Polish health ministry tweets out regularly, twice a day at the moment, the latest figures for the number of infections and for the number of virus-related deaths. And this morning, it tweeted out that the number of reported cases has exceeded 10,000 for the first time. And the number of virus-related deaths in Poland to this point is 404.
Now, Germany, right next to Poland, has 150,000 reported infections. Is there a sense that the numbers in Poland are actually a lot higher than what's being reported?
Well, one of the criticisms of the administration in Poland, especially by the political opposition and some health administrators, is that Poland is not carrying out sufficient numbers of tests. It is, in fact, a very low rate of tests that it's carrying out. It's the fifth lowest in the European Union. It's getting higher. It's increasing on a daily basis. The capacity is increasing. I think it's yesterday, in the previous 24 hours, it was over 11,000. But as I say, the only countries in the European Union which have a lower testing rate per 1 million inhabitants are countries like Greece, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary. None of the countries in Western Europe or the Baltics in the north of Europe, they have much higher rates of testing. So the criticism is we don't really know the true extent of the number of cases if we're not testing at a very high rate.
Adam, there's a presidential election coming up in Poland in just a matter of weeks. Is that going to happen?
That is the subject of enormous controversy. The government says it wants to go ahead and is seriously pushing it ahead. It says constitutionally it isn't allowed to postpone it. Now, it must be said at this point, the government's ally, the incumbent president, Andrzej Duda, is the clear favorite to win that election. So you can see an obvious motivation on the behalf of the government to go ahead and have this election next month. The opposition, and not just the opposition, the European Union, even Poland's own electoral commission has raised concerns about having elections next month. And the opposition would rather have it postponed to a time when the country is not in the middle of this crisis, of this pandemic. Now, what the government is saying, it's come up with a proposal. Well, we realize that this is maybe endangering the lives of people if we force them to go out. What we'll do is we'll do the only safe way of doing this and have a postal-only vote. There are still complications with that, because obviously that involves large numbers of postal workers who will be having to distribute voting ballots, take them in. And how do you do that with social distancing? So this is a very controversial point. And the opposition here and human rights groups are saying this is actually the government using the coronavirus to make a power grab.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see what happens, because, as you know, we've got an election here in this country coming up in about 6 months' time. That is the BBC's Adam Easton in Warsaw, Poland. Adam, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, here in this country, the CDC estimates that 8 out of 10 COVID deaths have been adults 65 and older. And making sure those people are comfortable in their final days is an unprecedented challenge for hospice care workers, who are also finding it difficult to help people dying from other conditions. Joining us now is Dr. Margaret Drickamer, who is medical director for the University of North Carolina Hospice Care. Her work focuses on geriatrics and end-of-life care. Dr. Drickamer, welcome.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, Jeremy.
You too. And how has COVID-19 changed your program and what you do?
Wow, it has changed, you know, everything. It has become a very isolated experience. Everybody's being limited in who they can see. Hospitals often allow nobody to come in, or maybe one person right at the end of somebody's life. Even hospices are limiting the number of people who can come and be with their loved ones as they are nearing the end of life or actively dying.
Have you had elderly patients with COVID-19 who decide that they want to spend their final days at home? And is that possible for them to do it?
Yes. It's difficult because you have to have caregivers in the home who are willing and able to take care of them. We have one case where, you know, the husband came home, but then the wife started getting sick from COVID and wasn't able to take care of her husband because she was getting sick. And mm-hmm. the kids were trying to decide if they could come in and do it, but they would be exposing themselves to COVID then. But we do have those patients. We do have nurses that go in, nursing assistants, and we do help direct the palliation of the symptoms.
Well, and you say that COVID and respiratory-related death, like what is seen with COVID, is actually one of the toughest kind of deaths. Why do you say that?
Well, the whole idea of air hunger and not being able to breathe is scary in and of itself. And when people have it, they get very anxious, and that makes them breathe less well. And it is a time when many people panic. And being able to keep people's respirations even and to sort of dull some of that feeling in their brain of desperately needing to breathe is, you know, something that hospice physicians and palliative care physicians learn how to do, and we're pretty good at doing it. We can make people comfortable, but you have to have the access to people who understand it and to the medicines that you need.
You mentioned that it's not just people with COVID, but people with all kinds of other conditions who may be nearing the end of their life and that this is affecting them as well. Give me an example of that.
I had a patient recently in the hospital who had been in a nursing home. The nursing home has been locked down for 3 weeks, and for good reason. As you know, as soon as you get one case in a nursing home, you're going to get 60 or 100 cases, right, and quite a few of those people may die. So that means the family had not seen him for 3 weeks. He came into the hospital sick, not from COVID, from other things. I did a lot of FaceTiming using my telephone. We're trying to get iPads in and other ways that people can, you know, help a loved one in the hospital talk to more relatives than what's allowed in. Even here at hospice, we only allow 2 different people throughout the person's stay. And God forbid you've got 3 children, you're going to have to choose which one you're not going to see. Mm-hmm. Brings up the old, you know, mom always liked you best kind of
right.
Situation of people deciding who they will have with them and who they're not going to have with them as they die.
Well, you mentioned FaceTime. I mean, are you mm-hmm. seeing elderly patients be able to embrace technology to the extent that they're able to use FaceTime and at least talk to their loved ones?
Well, a lot of elderly people are amazingly savvy, but a lot of them are not. The gentleman I was just referring to has a degree of dementia, and it was just a lovely expression on his face when he realized that it was actually his son in my telephone, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, it wasn't just the voice, that he could see the person. So, you know, you don't have to be a tech whiz to appreciate the fact that you're actually seeing a person in your family real time. You just have to have somebody there that can set it up for you.
Margaret Drickamer, with all of the people dealing with COVID-19 and all of the ways that we are, what do you need in the world of hospice care right now that you don't have that would make things better for these patients who are at the end of their life?
Well, I mean, I think just as I was saying, having an iPad, something bigger than a telephone, and the ability to use it, it's all good and fine, though, if we have it on our end. If the family doesn't have it at their end, then that's not going to work. And not everybody even has iPhones. You know, there's a lot of rural, very rural areas here where people don't necessarily have the tech savvy that we would like. But I had to recently sit with a patient who, again, had been in the hospital for a couple of weeks, had not seen his wife, and I had to tell him that he had metastatic cancer. And we had his wife on the phone, but it's just not the same. Mm-hmm. It's just ripping us apart. You know, a family will come in and say, oh, please, can't we just bring in a couple more people? Can't somebody please come in? And you're going, you know, I can't let everybody in. And, you know, if the hospice nurses start getting sick, we're really going to be sunk. But it's just so hard because that's not how we work with people who are dying. We want, you know, them to be surrounded by the people that they need to have with them. And it's very hard on all of us. In the COVID wards, it's such a dilemma to exclude what could make somebody the most happy as they are facing the end of their life.
That is Margaret Drickamer, who is the medical director for the University of North Carolina Hospice Care. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And new evidence from Northern California shows that people were dying of the coronavirus as far back as early February. Autopsies show that two people who died in Santa Clara County on February 6th and the 17th tested positive for the virus. Before this, the earliest known deaths were in late February in Washington State. To explain what this means, we're joined now by Dr. Peter Hotez from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Welcome, doctor. And let's first start off by talking about this death on February 6th. That means that person was almost certainly infected in January. The county's chief medical officer told the New York Times that they probably picked up the disease in the community. So she's essentially saying there was community spread in the U.S. as far back as late January. What does this tell you?
Well, thanks so much. I mean, what it tells you is that that community transmission was going on for quite a while before it was picked up. And the reason that's so significant is that now there are a couple of studies showing, and including studies out of Boston from my colleague Mark Lipsitch at Harvard School of Public Health, Chan School of Public Health, that shows that the longer transmission is sustained before you intervene, potentially the more the severe the epidemic. So, for instance, if transmission goes on for 6 weeks before you intervene with social distancing, that could mean 2,000 admissions to the intensive care unit versus if you intervene within a week, that could mean maybe 20, a three-log difference. And this was, his group showed this in several different cities in China. So the fact that transmission has been going on potentially since the end of January, pretty early on in the COVID pandemic. It means that helps explain why the United States probably has one of the worst epidemics of any single nation, and may also explain why things were so terrible in New York and New Jersey. Potentially there was a lot of transmission going on before it was really picked up and you could put in the social distancing.
Yeah, that makes us think about all of the timelines that we've been talking about over the last few weeks and the last few months. Does this information tell us anything about the disease itself? I mean, how lethal it is, how it actually spreads over time, and we're talking so much about fatality rates.
Yeah, it's really showing kind of a two-faced side to this virus and epidemic, using the symbol of the Janus, right, where you have one group of individuals that's getting very sick and going into intensive care units, and another group that maybe quite a substantial size group, maybe 18 to 50%, according to some estimates, with minimal or no symptoms that are walking around transmitting the virus. And this is why it's been so hard to contain it and so hard to mitigate against it, because you have this big cohort of individuals that are out and about in the community and in stores and spreading the virus, but then this other substantial subset getting so sick, and that is a very powerful combination that has led to so many deaths here in this country.
So much that we're learning and so much more to learn as we work on trying to combat this virus. That's Dr. Peter Hotez, a professor of virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone is learning to adapt in this new world, including millions of teachers who now have to make this distance learning thing work. There's a lot to consider: wrangling and keeping the attention of your students, being attuned to their emotional and physical well-being, and managing what can easily become an around-the-clock job. Today, we're going to check in on two teachers. First, let me introduce you to Jim Perry. He teaches at Stewartville Middle and High School in Stewartville, Minnesota, and he joins us now from his home. And Jim, welcome. How are you doing?
We're doing well. Distance learning is kind of exhausting, though. I would much rather be in the classroom, and I miss that face-to-face interaction that I normally would have with my students.
Yeah, that makes sense when you really think about it. I mean, you're a teacher, but you're also a coordinator for this program that focuses on the social and emotional well-being of your students. So I can imagine that face-to-face interaction means a lot. How have you been able to navigate this work with the kids remotely?
I was looking for a creative way, knowing that I might not have face-to-face time with them on Google Meet or through messages, to be able to continue to teach the character lessons about life that we normally use in class. So I started recording these videos called Reach Reflections and sending those out through social media and actually as lessons for my students and their families to watch together.
And what's been the reaction from the students?
Right away, within the first couple of days, I had a parent that emailed me to say that his family sits down in the evening to watch the videos together, to kind of process the meaning behind the videos and the message being given, and that they are doing their best to put that message into action the next day. To me, that's really what it's all about.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said about being exhausted. I mean, I just can only imagine, too, trying to come up with ingenious ways of being able to interact with the children since you can't see them face to face. You've been able to do that, but this takes a lot of work. I was actually hearing that your days are really, really long.
Yeah, my days have been very long. So I work with students who need support, and that starts before 7 o'clock in the morning. And depending on the situation of the day, I can still be in contact with students as late as 11 or 11:30 at night. Some of that does get in the way of family. I've got three children of my own. They're 17, 16, and 15. And there are certain days that they come out and actually join me while I'm filming the videos. I do them outside in an area park. We go for a walk and we talk about the benefits of outside time and exercise while recording these messages about gratitude, compassion, acceptance, meaning, forgiveness, and ideas like that. So I'm trying to include my children in these messages as much as I can as well.
Yeah. What are some of the challenges that your students are dealing with? I mean, you just mentioned you're talking to them late into the night and early in the morning.
Right. Well, you know, my focus all along with the REACH program has been on adverse childhood experiences and trauma in the home or difficulties in the home. Some of them have families that there's unemployment has become an issue or food insecurity has become an issue. And they're trying to figure out how to navigate a brand new world. And as teachers, I feel like it's part of our job not only to teach content, but to also help them learn how to navigate the brand new world and find their own place in it.
Hmm.
A lot of the lessons that I talk through are about and are directly influenced by my upbringing and the difficulties that I had as a youth growing up here in town, knowing that, again, adversity is everywhere. It's not something new. It's not something that we need to shy away from. We just need to do our best to help others through it by providing unconditional love and non-judgmental support.
Yeah, this is obvious, and it's so obvious for really all teachers. I mean, this is not just a job for you. This is a mission for you. It is a scary time, not only for adults, but for children, as you see every single day. What are the things that you're thinking about as you move through the rest of this school year and really the unknowns as we move into the summer and then the potential for next school year?
Yeah, that's a scary thought. You know, honestly, I am thinking day to day, and anything that I can do to offer my students and their families and kids everywhere. I'm not just concerned about my own students, but I'm concerned about the emotional well-being of students everywhere in the country. As teachers, what is it that we can do on a daily basis to offer compassion and understanding and set that example and set that bar really high, knowing that these are all qualities that we want them to be able to share with others themselves?
Mm. That's Jim Perry. He's a teacher at Stuartville Middle and High School in Stuartville, Minnesota. Jim, thank you so much for your work, and please take care of yourself.
Thank you very much. I'm blessed to get to do what I do.
And now let's go to Pritchard, West Virginia to talk with Amber McCoy. She's a fourth grade teacher and president of the Wayne County Education Association. Amber, welcome and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We actually heard from Jim Perry in Minnesota. He's a teacher there. He's found himself working these really long hours to maintain contact with his students. We know that teachers are not required to reach out to their students every day. I'm wondering from you, how have you maintained communication with your students during this outbreak?
Well, I will tell you, whenever people ask me about this, I always say I went from managing 21 nine-year-olds from 7 to 3. I've gone from that to managing 21 nine-year-olds, 42 parents, two online classroom platforms. I mean, it's a lot. But I want to maintain as much normalcy for my kids as I can, and they're used to seeing me every day. So I set up a Facebook page for my class. It's a closed group, and my kids log on at 7 every evening, and every evening we do, I read aloud, the kids comment, you know, about what we're reading, and we've done a Zoom meeting so everybody could see each other and show off their pets. That was the biggie on our Zoom meeting, was everybody wanted to show their pets.
Oh, I can imagine that. They're home. They have a lot of things to show you now.
Yes.
When you talked about the parents being another set of circumstances that you're managing, as a parent, I'm wondering, what can we do to make it easier for you? I mean, I chuckled at that, but the struggle is actually real for parents who are trying to separate that home time and school time.
Yes, it absolutely is. And for me, whenever I assign things to my kids, I want to make sure that there is as little parent involvement as possible, because many parents are still going to work every day. I completely understand what it is to be that person. So we use our online curriculum a lot, and it has an instructional module within it. It shouldn't require a whole lot of parent input. Now, the extra things that I've assigned for my kids, like following a recipe and cooking something for your family, those are the things that I'm trying to incorporate into school. Mm-hmm. For me, I would much rather my parents reach out to me at any time that there's an issue, because that eliminates the stress from the home. And I would rather answer a question immediately than have my 9-year-olds worried about their parents adding to their stress and anxiety at this time.
There are so many factors, though, that are outside of your control. How are you doing and how are you navigating? You know, you're part counselor, part teacher, part friend to your students. It's a lot to carry.
It is a lot. And I'll tell you, here's one of our biggest concerns is we have a goal of making contact with every student or their parent twice a week. So whenever we weren't able to establish those connections early on in this process, we had teachers that would get on the school bus that was running to the child's house that they hadn't been able to reach to deliver instructional materials, to say hello. We passed out computers. You know, those things have been a blessing.
And it sounds like it's been helpful for you because it's given you peace of mind that you can still be on that mission, that track that you're on in trying to prepare your students for fifth grade in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, we're all worried and we're all concerned, but I feel like that the normalcy really helps kids, as much routine as possible. You know, every morning we get up, we have breakfast, 9 o'clock we start and we do our math and our language. Or if parents are still working, then set aside a time in the evening to work on that. Kids thrive under routine and structure.
Routine and structure, absolutely. That's fourth grade teacher Amber McCoy. She's also president of the Wayne County Education Association in West Virginia. Amber, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
If you haven't been paying attention to President Trump's daily coronavirus briefings, here's an update. Last week, he made this announcement about the World Health Organization.
Today, I'm instructing my administration to halt funding of the World Health Organization while a review is conducted to assess.
Then on Monday, he called out Maryland's Republican Governor Larry Hogan, saying Hogan didn't understand a White House list of testing sites in the state.
Some of the governors, like, as an example, the governor from Maryland didn't really understand the list. He didn't understand too much about what was going on. So now I think he'll be able to do that.
On Tuesday, Trump responded to criticism of his administration's handling of testing.
We've tested more than every country in the world, even put together.
That is not even close to true. And yesterday, the president said he was temporarily halting green cards.
I will be issuing a temporary suspension of immigration into the United States. You heard about that last night.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Mara, when you put all that together, what is the president's goal in these briefings? What is he trying to do?
Well, he's trying to get his ratings up and convince people that he's doing a good job, but he's also trying to rally his base. You know, when he attacks immigrants or multinational institutions like the WHO or governors, he is trying to gin up his hardcore conservative base. Now, usually he does that with go-to foils like reporters or immigrants. But when you heard him attacking Larry Hogan there, that was a little different. Usually he goes after Democratic governors of battleground states. This time he went after a Republican governor of a very blue state who also happens to be the chairman of the National Governors Association.
But why is he talking to his base in this moment? He always talks about how he's got such high ratings among his base anyway. Wouldn't he want to spend this time talking to a broader swath of the country in the middle of a national crisis?
That is not his strategy. This is a person running for re-election, and his strategy is to keep his base fired up and then expand it, not by moving to the center, but by finding other voters through sophisticated digital outreach that resemble his base, other white non-college voters who didn't turn out in 2016 but might be convinced to turn out in 2020, people who share his views about immigrants or people who consume a lot of conservative talk radio. That's the strategy. Keep the base fired up and try to make it bigger by finding like-minded people. And that's the strategy, you know, finding other white non-college voters, for instance. That's the strategy that you can see behind a lot of these attacks from the podium of the briefing room.
Well, and how's that working for him right now with 6 months to go before the election? What do we know about his approval ratings, et cetera?
His approval ratings have went up a little. They've gone back down to pretty much where he's been all along, in that 43 to 46% range. He got 46.1% of the ballot in 2016, and that's where he's been stuck. Now, in head-to-head matchups with Joe Biden, he's generally trailing by about 7 points, sometimes doing a little bit better in the battleground. But he has a lot of advantages as an incumbent, a lot of money, big digital operation, a head start. But he's still really on his back foot as he's starting this election year.
Mara, in addition to trying to talk to his base, the president has also been sending some mixed messages to everyone. He initially said the virus was like the flu and would be under control by April. He has touted the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine, but a new analysis, though limited and not peer-reviewed, did show no benefit to people who took it in VA hospitals. Is there any pushback when he makes these unverified claims at the podium?
Well, polling shows that he is paying a price for some of this. The number of people who trust him in this crisis, who believes what he says, who think he's handling it well, is going down. On the other hand, the president has done this his entire career. He tries to control the narrative. He basically is living for the news cycle. You know, he wants to create his own reality, even temporarily. And he did it as a casino owner, as a pitch man, as a self-brander, as a reality TV show. And the big question now is, will it work for him in a pandemic and a recession?
I want to ask you one more thing. Something else that has come up in these briefings is mail-in voting. Many voting groups and Democrats are calling for expanded mail-in voting this November. The president has pushed back on that. There are some who believe he's trying to make sure the post office doesn't have enough money to carry that out on a big scale. Does the president have the ability to stop Americans from having mail-in ballots this November?
Not with the stroke of a pen, but ballot access is the civil rights issue of our time, and mail-in voting happens to be the frontline battle in that war right now. You know, the president believes, as do many Republicans, that anything that increases turnout, as mail-in ballots could do in a pandemic, works against Republican candidates. There are just more potential Democrats out there in the population than Republicans. And this is going to be a huge fight because Democrats want to make it as easy as possible for as many people to vote, and Republicans don't.
That is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you. And Here It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.